Good afternoon, and welcome to today's webcast titled State Legislation on Ocean and Coastal Acidification. This webcast is sponsored by EPA's Watershed Academy in the Office of Wetlands, Ocean, and Watersheds, also known as OWOW, in EPA, in partnership with the Coastal States Organization. I am Holly Galavati in EPA's Ocean and Coastal Management Branch. Thank you all for joining us today. I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Karen Braby. Karen provides strategic leadership on all things ocean within the state of Oregon and across the West Coast as the manager of the Marine Resources Program for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Karen and her staff build partnerships with industry, academic researchers, tribal governments, agencies, stakeholders, and elected officials to collaboratively define and achieve both economic and ecosystem resilience. Her work is grounded in both fishery and economic and ecosystem issues, with a particular focus on changing ocean conditions, including ocean acidification and hypoxia. As co-chair of Oregon's legislatively created Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Coordinating Council and a council member on the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, Karen is helping West Coast communities and fisheries develop successful strategies to adapt to and mitigate ocean change. She received her doctorate from Stanford University's Hopkins Marine Station and has conducted scientific research from estuaries out to the deep sea hydrothermal vents of the Pacific Ocean. Karen's career began by toddling through West Coast tide pools from the time she could first walk. Take it away, Karen.
Hi, everyone, and thanks so much for including me in this great webinar today. I enjoy hearing different perspectives on the problems that we're all facing and continuing to share tools that we can borrow from one another as we're building solutions and policies across the country and in fact, globally. So I am bringing a number of different hats to the webinar today, but I am going to try and focus on Oregon, both the context in which we're experiencing OAH impacts, as well as how we've moved forward. And I will touch on state legislation, which has been significant in our progress moving forward. But I'm not going to get into a lot of specifics about that. Like Justine, I'm going to focus maybe more specifically on how we are building aligned approaches across the West Coast and really using the ocean acidification and hypoxia action plan to focus on the ground efforts. So to begin with, I am going to talk about what we've all seen, and I can't help but start these types of talks just reminding myself and everyone I'm talking to about what we are experiencing today, and in particular, recent collaborations across the West Coast and East Coast space on ocean and coastal states. Really has demonstrated to me that we're experiencing very different things in different parts of the world. And the West Coast and even the Hawaiian Islands, these time series shown here, are currently experiencing significant manifestation of ocean acidification. So this is something we're dealing with real time now, not something that we're projecting for the next decades. And trying to prepare ourselves for. And so that's a different kind of situation. And it presents challenges in terms of understanding how to deal with those challenges, as well as opportunities to share lessons learned. And so hopefully there will be some of those as we kind of go through this. So like these graphs show, there is a very profound connection between atmospheric CO2 and what we're experiencing in terms of ocean chemistry and on the West Coast, where even though these data are quite old, the map on the right is from 2013. What we're experiencing is seasonal upwelling that for 3 to 4 to 5 months is presenting itself along the coast, which is our most productive portion of our federal EEZ access to ocean resources. And so these areas where we live, where we fish, where we recreate are the areas that are being impacted by the seasonal upwelling and decreasing pH and related metrics. So for Oregon, we really also are experiencing severe seasonal hypoxia, and deoxygenation or hypoxia is starting to become more part of the dialogue globally, but for Oregon and really into Washington as well in the last few years, we've experienced severe summer hypoxia events that are related to high productivity and then decomposition and usage of available oxygen that have really changed distributions of species, at the very least, if not mortality of species, in broad, wide sweeping areas of the shelf off the Pacific Northwest. So as I move forward through my talk, I am really going to combine these into ocean acidification and hypoxia. You won't hear me talk about coastal, but really I'm talking about all of that and changing ocean conditions generally. Also important context for Oregon is that we are part of the West Coast and particularly Pacific Northwest shellfish aquaculture industry, which is hundreds of millions of dollars annually, which is at risk from propagation due to the ocean acidification that we are experiencing now, and in fact have been experiencing for about 15 years now. So this is a story where we have a lot of jobs and resources at risk in coastal economies and can be mitigated through different culture practices. And so it's really a canary in the coal mine story with a happy ending to a degree, in that in our on-land culture facilities can control and buffer chemistry successfully to continue the propagation systems in order to fuel shellfish aquaculture, where oysters are grown out in the estuaries and bays in Oregon, Washington, and California. But we're starting to understand the grow out operations may be detecting a difficulty even in adult or larger oysters, not just in the juveniles that are propagated in these terrestrial grow operations. So this is a successful story, but with an uncertain future as we move forward and ocean acidification worsens. I think the other thing that we know about the West Coast is that the food web is being undermined broadly throughout this EEZ space. And Nina Bednarsik, Dr. Richard Feely, and others have collaborated to describe the impacts they're seeing in the wild of pteropods, sea butterflies, the inset photo showing a pteropod that was collected and has pitting from ocean acidification from the wild. So this is not a lab experiment, but rather in situ effects. And the same group has now demonstrated impacts on Dungeness crab larvae. The paper just came out in January of this year and made quite a splash, both with the crab industry across the West Coast as well as managers. This is the first in situ evidence of impacts from ocean acidification. And by impacts, I mean correlation of impacts rather than cause and effect, but that work is still in progress and is likely to reveal serious vulnerabilities of this species. And like oysters, Dungeness crab is incredibly economically important. It's Oregon's single most important wild commercial fishery, very important for sport fisheries, and obviously is an important ecosystem species as well. For crab, the context relative to ocean acidification impacts in Oregon extends into this growing story that we're developing around biotoxin events, harmful algal blooms, and accumulation of biotoxins in seafood products, particularly in thinking about public health, but in the ecosystem writ large. And the map shows the harmful algal bloom event in 2015, which was unprecedented previously, and I would argue is still causing problems in Oregon's ecosystem and food web today, 5 years later. Certainly last year, we were still seeing remnants of it. And so these massive biotoxin events that are facilitated by acidification conditions, certainly by warming and other aspects of warming, or ocean change, are really facilitating the development of biotoxins, and that's propagating throughout the ecosystem and our system. So I'm going to give you a third way that Dungeness crab is connecting to ocean change impacts, and including acidification, but that connection has yet to be strongly correlated. But what we are seeing on the West Coast is that single pot fixed gear, Dungeness crab pots, analogous to but much larger than the lobster pots on the East Coast, are increasingly interacting with humpback whales on the West Coast, right whales on the East Coast. For the West Coast, the story really started in 2015, the same kind of time frame that the biotoxin event really hit. And here, what we have observed, what we're piecing together, is that whale behavior essentially changed. And as we had the marine heat wave sweep across the West Coast, we had biotoxin events sweep across the West Coast, the forage for these baleen large whales moved their distribution. Not surprising, but guess what? So the whales followed the food, also not surprising. But it's also not something that we necessarily would project, that we would look into the future and say, what we need to plan for is humpback whales changing their behavior and following forage into different locations that's going to overlap more significantly with Dungeness crab fishing gear. But in fact, that is what seems to have happened, and humpback whales have been entangled at an order of magnitude greater frequency than prior to the marine heat wave. So now we have protected species that are being impacted by changing ocean conditions and affecting fisheries and economics, as well as the conservation of very important species. So it's with these kinds of stories running in the background of my head and within the discussions in Oregon and across the West Coast that we really talk about what actions should we be taking and are those meaningful to address some of these really super big problems, massive problems that we're seeing as our ocean is changing. So as Holly mentioned, I'm with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I manage a program that's about a tenth of the size of the agency, and we're all focused on ocean management issues from research to fisheries management, policy development, and so on. I am also a key contact for the governor's office and often represent the state on ocean acidification issues. And I get to work with Justine on a regular basis for our West Coast team of folks working on policy development and action. Oregon policy really for me falls into three buckets. One is legislative action, two is governor mandates, and three is agency policy. Within our mandates from the legislature and governor, we have discretion to develop policies in a variety of ways through our rulemaking body, and for ODFW, that's the Fish and Wildlife Commission. So obviously the focus of today's webinar is on legislative actions, and that has been very important in the state of Oregon. And so I'll describe this at a high level right now, but I'm going to focus on really a couple of products from the governor mandates and then finish up with some discussion about agency action and legislative action that is upcoming. So while I'm paused on this slide, legislative policy has been important since Oregon was in the middle of discovering the problem with oyster aquaculture. And our legislature has invested a number of times in scientific research to figure out what that problem was and solve it, as well as install instruments to allow oyster aquaculture to continue and be productive. The legislature has also developed the Ocean Science Trust. California also has an Ocean Science Trust, which is much more developed and mature of an institution. But for Oregon, this is something we've been developing for about 5 years, and we are working on making that an effective way to help fund additional research projects and develop policy recommendations for the state on a variety of ocean issues. And that was created by the legislature. Additionally, the legislature created the OAH Council, of which I'm a co-chair with my colleague and co-chair, Jack Barth, Dr. Jack Barth from Oregon State University. That council has been meeting since 2018. So we have, the Ocean Science Trust has been in existence for about 5 years. The state's been investing in ocean acidification issues since about 2006, and the council is the newest on the scene, having been in existence since 2018. So for governor mandates, I'm going to focus on two aspects. One is the PCC, and I'll start with that. And as Justine alluded to, the PCC, the Pacific Coast Collaborative, has been working for some time across the West Coast to coordinate on climate and energy issues generally. And one of the focuses of that group, foci of that group, has been in addressing ocean acidification specifically. And through the PCC governor's leadership and development, we have launched and now sent out into the global community this concept of an international alliance to combat ocean acidification, which has been a process that was started in 2016 and has made just amazing progress since then. The group is really organized around five major areas of action, and I wanted to describe this because it not only provides a framework for much of what Justine talked about, but is very much a framework for how Oregon has developed a series of actions moving forward. The first area is in scientific understanding. The second area is in reducing causes of ocean acidification. And you can build in there carbon dioxide emissions or excess carbon dioxide. The third is to look at resilience, adaptation, mitigation of the problems that we're seeing. The fourth is to expand public awareness, and the fifth is to build international support. And so the OA Alliance has many members. I believe our current tally is well over 80. And we have a number of just really interesting things happening all over the world to achieve outcomes in those areas. The other thing that the Pacific Coast Collaborative has done, Justine's already touched on, which is this concept of thinking more collectively about what a monitoring network might look like, where we have capacity, where we don't have capacity, where we have priorities to fill gaps collectively. And this has been a topic of interest both with the PCC and then with a partnership that we built with the Interagency Working Group on Ocean Acidification, of which EPA, NOAA, and many other federal agencies are partners, and Holly already described that group. And the Interagency Working Group on OA has been very central to our thinking and our capacity to build on our thoughts about the inventory and gaps and building a stronger monitoring network on the West Coast. As Justine mentioned, the inventory covers Alaska, British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and California. And so it covers a very broad space, but we have some critical questions we need to address before we are going to be able to move forward effectively on filling gaps, and particularly actually defining what a regional gap looks like and how we can define that and effectively fill it with limited resources that are a common problem among all of us. So focusing now down into Oregon specifically, another governor mandate was to ask the legislatively created Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Council in Oregon to build the governor's action plan in compliance or as a deliverable to the OA Alliance or the International Alliance to Combat Ocean Acidification. So here, the action plan is built around the same five themes that are the OA Alliance themes, science and monitoring being the first, mitigation, reducing causes of CO2 and OAH is theme two, theme three, promoting resilience, theme four, raising awareness, and theme five, committing resources to action. So these phrasings are more appropriate at the state level versus the international level, but they essentially are intended to and incorporate the same concepts as the OA Alliance Action Plan guidance. Whoops, got a little delay. I'm going to go back one. So first, I wanted to highlight three areas, three of these themes with example projects or concepts as we're moving forward. And the first is in the monitoring and what we have done within the state of Oregon to address gaps. And this photograph is of an aerial photograph of Tillamook Bay, which Holly already mentioned is one of the National Estuary Partnership locations. And in fact, the Tillamook Estuary Partnership has been lead on establishing the first long-term monitoring in this very important Oregon estuary. It's Oregon's biggest estuary. It's very important for oyster aquaculture operations. And up until last year, 2019, did not have a dedicated monitoring station. I do want to very much call out the work of the Newport EPA lab in doing a significant amount of work on a very intensive and thorough project. They're still in the middle of that project in this estuary, and they have been very supportive of establishing just an ongoing oceanographic, basically a seabird data sonde type monitoring system for the Tillamook Estuary. This is an example of how the action plan has helped us really kind of focus in on potential projects with actual partners and actual funding needs and getting work done on the ground to really kind of achieve some of these larger goals. So hats off to the EPA for their work there, as well as the National Estuary Partnership for continuing the good work that they've started. Yes, we will need more funding to keep it going in the long term, but I'll get to that in a minute. So another area where the Oregon OAH Action Plan is focused is in raising awareness. And this will be a key area of activity this year for the council. In addition to doing typical outreach events, the photo is showing an event 2 years ago at the Oregon Coast Aquarium, which sadly has just closed its doors to address the COVID-19 exposure issue. We have built a series of informational brochures to describe the problem of ocean acidification and impacts to species that Oregonians in particular care about. And we have established this year an education and outreach committee, which includes a lot of partners outside of OAH Council membership to bring in folks to really think about this much more broadly and over the next 5 years. The last one I wanted to touch on is that is committing resources to action. And this is the second big area of action under the action plan for Oregon this year. And that is building connections and understanding between agencies within Oregon through description of how our agency mandates connect to ocean change, policies we already have in effect, monitoring we already have in effect, and the opportunities for building on those existing programs moving forward and seeing that as a real opportunity. It says audio connection is restored. Hopefully you guys can still hear me.
Yes, I can still hear you.
Great. So moving on, and I'm almost done, is that in addition to working on kind of agency connections and planning over the next 5 years, in addition to building our products and our goals around education and outreach and awareness on this topic, we have a number of other things that are going on. First, within my agency, as an example only, we have a policy that is being presented to our Fish and Wildlife Commission on climate and ocean change, really focusing on applying a lens of climate and ocean change across all of the actions that the Fish and Wildlife Agency is doing in terms of management, research, and policy, and making sure that that's integrated into our thinking and planning on the long term, both adapting to it, but then hopefully also providing capacity to mitigate some of the changes and at least lessen their impact. Outside of the agency, really across all Oregon agencies, this year we'll see the development, the finalization of the second version of the Oregon Climate Adaptation Framework, which is really the first one was in 2010, and so this is the 10-year update, and it's really intended to drive the interagency discussions about how we can connect to each other and make decisions moving forward that aren't in conflict. And so that will be finalized this year and is very consistent with some of the things I've already described. Another couple of things are upcoming and at least planned There's legislation that was presented in our session in February that unfortunately was not passed because essentially our legislature was not able to finish its business this session due to controversy over carbon legislation. We also have upcoming process on agency budgets and building new initiatives into agency budgets, the planning I already mentioned, and the education and outreach. But I do want to also focus on, in closing, our partners, the Department of Environmental Quality, which is our water quality agency for the state of Oregon. And they, for the first time, have included ocean acidification in their proposal in their integrated report that is going to be submitted to the EPA this coming April. And in that, ocean acidification is listed as Category 3 concern for Oregon, but they've also included this I believe a Category 5 shellfish harvest being impacted by harmful algal blooms within that integrated report. So I would just call out their leadership and thoughtful approach to really thinking about ocean change and how to build that into Oregon's potential designation of waterways being impacted. So here's the legislation that did not pass. I'm just pausing because I'm still sad that it did not get the time, the public discourse that it deserved. There's a number of research projects and investments that would have been funded through the state bill. And I think really ending with this is more a flag that while we are making a lot of progress, we still have a lot of work to do to bring ocean issues into focus, even within our discussions around terrestrial impacts from climate change. And we continue to be challenged by whether climate and ocean change are a priority or not, both within the state as well as obviously nationally and internationally. So with that, I'll just commit, we have a lot of work to do. We're doing a lot of work in Oregon, and I'm proud of that work, as well as on the West Coast, and grateful for the time to talk to you about it today.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Karin.